Cross the line. They say crime doesn't pay. I wanted to make sure of that. That's why I started a task force to seize drug money from dealers who constantly threaten our children. What does fighting drugs have to do with the county clerk's office? From fighting drugs to saying no to the pay raise, leadership isn't defined by what we say, but by what we do. $5.
To do the pay?
Drugs aren't just bad headlines. They're bad news for all our kids. When I was a municipal judge, I got parents to take more responsibility when their kids cross the line. They say crime doesn't pay. I wanted to make sure of that. That's why I started a task force to seize drug money from dealers who constantly threaten our children. What does fighting drugs have to do with the county clerk's office? From fighting drugs to saying no to the pay raise, leadership isn't defined by what we say, but by what we do.
We are.
All right, this is June 18, 1998. We're in McAllen, Texas, interviewing Juan de Dios Salinas Jr., county clerk elect for Hidalgo County, youngest ever, 29 years old.
29 years old.
So why don't you tell us how you did that? How did you get there? Talk about all your political career. I know that you've been a municipal judge or ran for school board or
yes,
tried
sir.
Or...
Yes, sir. I graduated from high school in 87, graduated from Texas A&M in 91. 5 days out of college, I became an administrative assistant to the county judge in Hidalgo County. That's where I was for 5 years, and we worked on several programs, and that was mostly how I got involved in local politics. Soon after college, of course, all our lives, our family's been involved in politics. I was appointed municipal judge in 1993, approximately.
Where?
In La Jolla. In La Jolla. That's where I was presiding. That's where I was residing right after college. So I was there approximately 4 years as a municipal judge. And it was an appointment.
How old were you? 22, 23?
I was about 23 years old. 23 years old. And I was the youngest municipal judge in the state of Texas then. So some of these things, you know, challenges, when they would tell me that I was too young, went over my head. And I didn't believe that. So, and it helped me work harder. So, after being municipal judge, I became an administrative assistant to the county judge for 5 years. I became an executive director to the JTPA program, the Junior Training Partnership Program in Hidalgo County, Hidalgo Willis County. I was there for about half a year, and that's when Contract on America, I call it, not with America, came, and they were cutting funds for JTPA training. And I thought it was a time to do less administration in JTPA, and more, and the little money that was coming to South Texas should be going into actual training. So because of that, John Sharp, our state controller, was trying to unite all workforce training. He asked me to come work with him. So I have been with him for 3 years, and I took an 8-month leave of unpaid leave of absence to run for county clerk. Reason I ran for county clerk was the current county clerk was going to run for county judge. And I see the county clerk's office as a service-oriented office. And I think it was a perfect opportunity to give services, especially to our Mexicanos in the rural area que live far from Edinburgh in the courthouse seat. So I thought it was an opportunity to try to do satellite offices that we don't have today. Para darle servicios, give them services in the county and the rural areas. So that's one of the reasons I ran for county clerk, and we won that office.
This is late 97, primary of 98.
Primary of 98, March of 98.
There's no Republican opponent, you're the elect.
Exactly. I'm the Democratic elect, and I don't have a Republican opponent, so in January I take office, I get sworn in. Today I work for the controller's office again to the end of the year until I take office.
Some of the appointments have been concurrent. No, you could not have worked at the county judge's office and municipal judge separately. It had to be at about the same time, no?
It was at the same time.
Right.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay.
I used to hold night court on Monday nights, at least once a month in La Jolla. That court took about, I used to spend about 6 hours the whole night. I would open the office at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, go to La Jolla after work in Edinburgh, and hold night court all the way. Why night court? People wouldn't have to take time from work to go take care of the situation. Whether it was a juvenile crime, whether it was a speeding ticket, I thought that the office should be open for them to take care of the situation, whether it was a speeding ticket or whatever. There was two municipal judges, Juan Garza and myself, and I held night court. It was an unpaid position, it was a voluntary position, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed giving services, so that's how I was able to do it concurrently.
Where did you get interested in politics, and when and why?
I got interested in politics. I was very young in Crystal City. My father was a head coach in Crystal City. And as a youngster, I remember some of the campaigns. Of course, I was young. I did not totally understand the reasoning behind the challenges and some of the situations we were in. I remember a little older when I was in maybe fifth grade. My father was the head coach in Pearsall, and I was having to leave the town of Pearsall. And again, because of politics. And it was after a year, my dad had been a head coach. And again, I was too young to totally understand, but old enough to understand that what politics was, sort of. So at the age of, in high school, my grandmother instilled in me that a certain faction in local politics in La Jolla were the Leos. My grandmother always used to tell us that we grew up that the Leos were bad people. They always treated people wrong. So all my life I've heard that, right? So when we came back to La Jolla, I told my mother, I remember one night saying, I'm going to go get educated. Get a further degree, advancement degree, get a college education, only for self-satisfaction, and then come back and run for mayor of La Jolla against the Leos and their faction. Reason was that there was lack of inclusiveness. As a kid in high school, I remember, you know, that only certain, if you belong to a certain faction, you would be included. And I would see that my dad would be left out of invitations to different things because he was not of a certain faction. You wouldn't get a job because you weren't of a certain faction. So I thought it was time to end that. And in order for me to do that, I thought that a college degree would better not only educate me, but give me the patience and the discipline to endure a campaign. So to answer your question, shortly, I guess all my life I've been involved in politics. It's just in what aspect? Directly, this is my first campaign. Indirectly, I've been involved in statewide campaigns, from Man Richards in college to local politics and school boards and things like that.
Well, some of your relatives have run for office, no?
Yes, yes.
Who are they and what have they done?
My grandfather was on the school board 15 years in La Jolla ISD.
What was his name?
His name was Juan de Dios Salinas Sr. I'm Juan de Dios Salinas III. My dad is Juan de Dios Salinas Jr. My uncle Fernando sat on the school board in La Jolla one or two terms. I'm sorry, I don't know how many terms. My Uncle Fito ran for mayor just recently in La Jolla. So all of us have been involved in politics in one way or another, just in different areas. So I had tried to start a campaign for school board in La Jolla. Unfortunately, what they call the comité in La Jolla did not choose me as a candidate for them.
What was that interview like?
Pretty interesting. There was different local leaders of the area, rural areas of La Jolla, who were sitting in a room and asked good professional questions. And they would have all of us, all the candidates or potential candidates wait, and they would take their turn. So, and we all knew each other. So, and, you know, it was interesting because it was the first time I had heard about these comité meetings, but I had never been to one. I had never seen it. They interviewed approximately 15, 20 minutes, and they asked me questions about how I felt about bilingual education, how I felt about the school district of La Jolla, and how, where it was headed, and things like that. So it was pretty interesting. After interviewing everybody, they then chose somebody, one of the interviews. Obviously, it wasn't me, and they announced it there. I thought it was kind of funny that they decided that, in such a quick turnaround, they didn't even consider it for a day or a couple hours, seeing as how there were four candidates they were interviewing. Apparently, they made a decision.
What was the killer question?
There wasn't any one, but one I do remember is how I felt about bilingual education and what I felt about local politics and if I was going to be a radical per se or if I was going to be in the norm. I remember those kind of questions. And,
well, did you ever ask anybody as to why you weren't chosen and what did they tell you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was asked. I asked because I thought that I was as good as candidates as any of them that were interviewed. The reason that I was told that I was not chosen for their candidate was that I did not put as many signs, political signs, in the local politics of Billy Leo's county clerk re-election. And my answer to them was, they want to put the future of the kids of La Jolla on how many signs are put up. It is unfortunate. So they were then told me that I had to be patient and I had to pay my dues, and then they would consider me. I did ask for inclusiveness in that meeting. I told them that I was a product of La Jolla High School, and I was ready to try to give back to the community in whatever way, directly or indirectly. And they asked me to be patient, and eventually maybe I'd be considered as a candidate. So of course you have the right to run against the candidate that was chosen, but then you have to, it was so short amount of time, you have to mount up some funds. Unless you're financially independent, like wealth, you don't have the funds to run against that person.
So who was it that ultimately became the candidate?
Mingo Villarreal became the candidate. He ran unopposed. He is administrative assistant to the county commissioner today in Precinct 3, which is Juan Rosé. He is the one that got chosen.
Did he get that job afterwards or already had that job?
He already had that job. He did that for Beto Salinas as a county commissioner. So.
And that includes La Jolla?
That includes La Jolla, yeah. So.
Who were some of the members of the comité?
Some of the members of the comité I remember are Amancio Chapa, Billy Leo, Lalo Mireles, who was a well-respected activist leader in Los Ébanos area, rural area of La Jolla School District. There were other people in there that I had just met that day, you know, that evening. But those are the ones that primarily I remember.
Any surprises? Were you surprised to see some people in there?
No. I didn't know who had the honor to do the interviewing of these candidates. But I figured it was some of those people that I mentioned.
Let's go back to the county clerk race. How much money did you have to raise, and how did you do that and spend, and how did you campaign?
Let's see. There was four of us running, okay, for the March primary.
Who was that?
It was myself. It was Celeste Cardenas Lees, Ronnie Perez, and Flor Estela Chavez. There's four of us running. I'm still looking at my contribution reports to see how much we spend or how much we owe to the bank. Pero we approximately spent about $50,000 in the March primary. And then in the runoff, which Celeste Cardenas Lees and myself state, we spent another $50,000.
So about $100,000 total.
We spent about $100,000 total, and we were overfunded. Overfunded in that, well, I should say we were underfunded compared to my challenger's campaign in the runoff. She spent $120,000 in the March primary alone. That's what we approximate. So that's where.
All right, we're back on the record. You were explaining about campaign financing, about the money you raised. You said you owe most of it to the bank.
Yes.
So how did you get it there? What did you do with it?
Okay, that's where I was going to get to, is that in the runoff, we had to borrow money from the bank, and we owe it today. We have a debt, approximately $60,000 in debt right now to the bank. So that's where we got most of our money, other than we had three major fundraisers, two of them which were golf tournaments. And I never thought that a golf tournament would be a fundraising experience, but they worked. We had a lot of good friends, volunteers who put together a golf tournament. And basically the gist was, I'm gonna give you the money anyway, I might as well play golf out of it. You know what I mean? So we did two major fundraisers that raised about $20,000 each, one which was in the runoff.
So this is a golf tournament?
A golf tournament.
Wow.
What we did was we got 36 teams, three-person teams, $500 per team, and then you can sponsor the hole, okay? So if you do your math, 500 times 36 is $18,000 alone, and then you can sponsor a hole for $200, I think that's what we're doing. So the short was that right after the March primary, we got a golf tournament together and we picked up $20,000 of the golf tournament. We had done that in November and we knew that it's a lot of work, but it was successful. So that's one of the things that put us over the hump for the runoff.
Now that's kind of male oriented. Did you get baited off of that?
No.
All the men are just out there doing their own thing?
Yeah, no, we got some women to play. But we left it open, you know, we as a matter of fact, it was, we were hoping that women would play because you get an advantage in the tee shots, you know, and things like that. But no, there was no comments, but we left it open, and there was a lot of women involved and volunteers in our campaign, so that helped us a lot.
Well, I went through some of the newspapers here. You did an expensive literature campaign. You got leaflets, you got posters, you had newspaper ads. I noticed the hand-painted sign outside the door when we came in to do the interview.
Yes, sir.
What did you do? How did you go about meeting the voters?
We did several mail-outs, targeted several voters. We did mail-outs to... we kind of hedged our bets. We didn't have that much money. Okay. And the money that we... We didn't have much money compared to our opponent. And the money we did have, we need to get it more bang out of the buck. We had two contested races locally in Hidalgo County that were heated, especially in the runoff. It was the county commissioner for precinct 2 and the county commissioner for precinct 4. Precinct 4 being the Edinburgh area, precinct 2 being the PSJA area, Far San Juan Alamo. So our mail-outs were targeted to those areas because those are the people who were going to go out to vote. We got, we hired some people locally, consultants, to show us who are the people who have voted in the last five Democratic primaries. And those are the ones we targeted, so we did mail-outs to them. That's how we got some interest in voting. We did one TV commercial, that's all we could afford. We used the same commercial for the primary as we did in the runoff.
The one you showed at the beginning of the day?
Yes, the one I showed early. And then something that we did in the, and I just remembered that we did in the runoff that really helped us out. We got the group Intocable to do a commercial on the radio for us.
Free?
Free.
Lara Zapata, your father knows him, or your uncle?
My dad was a coach there, and my campaign manager is Jaime Gonzalez, being from Zapata. And he has done some work for them as an attorney. So they lent us their voice. We wrote a script for them. A consultant said, Sarabasso wrote the script. And I'll try to get a copy of that for you because it was really interesting. The radio ad said something like, les habla Ricky Muñoz Intocable, quiero hablarles de otro amigo intocable en la posición de secretario de condado. And they go on saying that it's important that you get educated about the issues in both of the opponents. And this is, si les usan nuestra música de intocable, no canten, voten. So that was really good. And the closing for my speeches and the closing for the radio spot was saying, por favor, voten Juan de Dios y vayan con Dios. And so that helped out. It customized that it was different. People remembered it and people remembered the name. And what helped us out a lot, I know God was with us, because what helped us out in the runoff was the absentee week was only 1 week, and it happened to be Holy Week. So when you tell people, por favor, piensen de Dios, voten Juan de Dios Salinas en la boleta, esta Semana Santa, it helped. You know, it really helped.
What's the going rate to pay people to get out the vote like that around here?
It varies. It varies. To contract people to put signs, to contract people to leaflet, to contract people to carry, to pay for gas. I had to rent 6 vehicles, I believe, 4 of which were vans. At the end of the absentee, I remember making a check to Advantage Rental Car for $1,500. Okay, that's just an example of not payment directly to people to carry votes, but people the vehicles of getting the vote out. To answer your question, when you started, how did you win? We won the election, which was the runoff, by actually just taking our people to vote. I mean, we just outworked it. We the United Farm Workers endorsed us. They believed in our campaign, and they were a lot of help. They volunteered a lot of their time. They leaflet a lot of the Far San Juan Alamo. Again, remembering that the contested races in the local race was going to be Far San Juan Alamo, because they had a runoff for county commissioner. The county commissioner in the Edinburgh area had already won without a runoff, so I had some concerns. But being that other candidates that were running in the runoff were from Edinburgh, we knew people were going to vote. So we targeted both of those areas. We walked the streets in those areas. We leaflet those areas. Our mail out was to those areas. Our major concentration in neighborhood in colonias, when we would do coffees, era en las áreas de Far San Juan Alamo, Las Milpas, Hidalgo, y Edinburgh, because those are the people who are going to come out to vote.
Do the colonial residents vote?
Yes, they do. Yes.
Did you do voter registration out there?
We did not do voter registration because we got short of time. For the runoff, of course. For the March primary, we did. My mother, my father, my brothers, my family got involved in voter registration. People in colonias vote because they have reason to vote. They're the ones that live in situations that are less substantive than other people. And they don't live like that by choice. They don't want to live like that. So they get involved. They get involved about the issues. And they get people elected. They get involved with people that they want to get elected, who are going to listen to them, who know who the colonias are at least. I mean, if you went to the colonia, at least you recognize that they exist, ¿verdad? And then you see by driving down the road, obviously, that the roads are bad. So they, I answer that because they're important, because they're the ones that they have a lot of concerns that we need to look at.
I noticed in one of your literature pieces, if you don't mind me going through your stuff here, if I can find it quickly, you had a like a web page.
Yes.
I saw an address, a web address,
All our literature had the web page address on it. We had a web page on it, and we also had a phone number customized for the campaign at 668-VOTE, or 668-8-VOTE. They remembered for people to call us if they needed a ride to the polls, or they need information or disbursement of signs and things like that.
Did you get a lot of clicks onto the webpage? Or do you know?
I did, but it was more for curiosity.
The novelty of the
idea?
Yeah,
it wasn't interactive. It wasn't telling me, I had done it so that I would, my intent was to hear from the voters and the constituency of the county on what the county clerk's office concerns were, so we can evolve in the campaign early. Or just another way to contact us. So that it worked in a sense that there was another source or another media, a way of via of contacting our office.
Are you a techie?
I'm not a techie.
All
right. I'm not a techie. I need to get more involved with the technological, with a network, with a World Wide Web. But I think that it's important to give as many sources as we can for people to.
Well, I notice in your literature here in the newspapers also that that's what you're proposing is to make it interactive, the office with records to the public, and the branch and this computerized and all kinds of things that you got in the newspaper there.
One of the major issues in our campaign, one of the major differences between our campaign and our opponents was that I felt like anything that's public information should be on the internet. My opponents felt like they shouldn't be on the internet. They were afraid that their comments were in debates were that they were afraid that public information would be tapped into and changed. Well, as you know, anything that's public information, you can go get at the courthouse today. I just wanted to make it easy for a person in one end of the county or the valley or the state or the US or the world to get a simple marriage license application. Print it out on the computer, fill it out at home, bring it to the office, and they can take care of the situation there, or even mail it with a proper, documentation. So that's something that I propose that I'm going to work on to try to do in our office. I just feel like the more sources of ways of public information we can get to our constituents, the better it is, because it's an office that taxpayers pay for. We got to give the services.
Let me switch to the municipal judgeship for a minute, because I just remembered a thought. What was the hardest part about that job, or what did you find the most difficult about that particular job of being a municipal judge?
Working with juveniles and their parents. It was hard to be hard or harsh on a juvenile who had been in several fights a week before. To put a fine on their parents who are already indigent. So what I did a lot was a lot of community service. If Jose del Torre and Juanito Leal got in a fight last week in La Jolla High School, I would ask for both of them to come to night court or their parents. And I would, knowing that they're indigent, I was assigned to community service at the municipal court and then on weekends to work out the fine together. They had to figure out a way to wash the car, the police car, or work together and clean the municipal building. But that was the hardest
thing that I found. It was not easy being harsh on indigenous families.
Let me ask you a series of questions for opinions and comment. What is leadership?
Leadership, of course, itself, you know, different people have different opinions of leadership. What I think leadership is making your own decisions from information you gather out of observation and going forth with such information, whether it's in sports, whether it's in politics, whether it's in a colonia. Leadership is maybe gathering a group to talk to them about issues, as simple as that. Or leadership may be on the football field on Friday night, being a quarterback and leading the team down the field. There's different ways, the way I explain or I define leadership.
Who is the most effective Mexican-American leader today?
You asked me that today, and it's kind of hard to answer.
Which is the most effective?
A couple of years ago, I would have answered Henry Cisneros. But your question was saying effective. You threw effective in there. I think he's still a leader. In politics, he may not be effective, unfortunately.
Which is the most effective Mexican-American organization today?
In South Texas, and what I've been involved in, what I've seen, even though it's not a Mexican-American organization per se, I think the United Farm Workers have a lot of the Mexican-American issues at hand. So that is one that I feel is effective, at least in my area locally, and bringing out the issues of Mexican-Americans and some of the situations that they have.
What organizations do you belong to?
I belong to Avance. I sit on the board of Avance. I'm a Knights of Columbus in my parish, and I'm also involved with the Democratic Party locally. Those are the ones that are mostly involved with.
Do you belong to NALEO, or do Mexican Democrats, or Tejano Democrats, or?
No, not today. I'm going to start getting involved with the NALEO, now that I'm an elected official, of course. I think it's important. The Tejano Democrats have contacted me to get involved with them. I've talked to them. I have not yet joined them yet.
Do you need to get that beeper? Because somebody's really trying to get a hold of you. Let me turn this off. All right, we're back on. What is the most pressing issue facing Mexican Americans today?
Education. I think the education is a future, and it's the most pressing issue that I think is pressing our Hispanics, especially in South Texas and the border area.
Black-brown relations. What are the underpinnings of tensions between blacks and browns?
Locally, there isn't. I mean, we have some blacks in Hidalgo County, but we don't have many. But the ones we do, I think that we need to. There isn't tensions between them. The blacks, African Americans that we have in Hidalgo County, we need to know what their issues are, because that's eventually growing population in South Texas.
But you are aware of issues across the state and the nation between blacks and browns.
Correct.
What do you think some of those tensions are?
Personally, I think some of those tensions are that, you know, I think that African Americans have been more effective on getting their issues across to federal government and to Washington and statewide than Hispanics. Personal reason is that I think that they are perceived as more organized, and it's an unfortunate thing that we as Hispanics need to look at And we need to get organized to get our issues across, for our people to get heard in Washington and in Austin.
Relations between Chicanos and Mexicanos from Mexico. What are the underpinnings of tension there?
Locally, there isn't. I haven't seen any, at least. I think we all understand that we live in South Texas, and we live in Mexico. It just happens to be that we have a river that divides Mexico and Texas. This is, I think, one region of economic development region that includes La Frontera de Mexico. It is unfortunate that, again, that we have a river that divides us geographically, but we have a lot of people that contribute to economic development here locally, and our culture, as do we do over there. I think that we should be more open to across cultures and economic development. There should be more ease in having both of them there, because we live in what used to be Mexico today. It just happened that they moved the border from the West to Rio Grande, and sometimes our younger Hispanics forget that.
Well, you've used the word Hispanic here lately quite a lot. What about relations between Chicanos and other Latinos under the Hispanic umbrella? Cubans, Puerto Ricans, Central Americans, what are the underpinnings of tension there?
Nationwide, because locally, we do not see as many other Latinos. The ones we see are just Mexican American and Hispanos. We don't see a lot of Cuban Americans. We don't see a lot of Puerto Rican Americans. We don't see a lot of other type of Hispanic backgrounds. I understand that, you know, in other states, in Florida, things like that, you know, tensions are high and they're falling to Republican ranks, and it's unfortunate because I don't think that our ideals are with Republican ideas.
Before the interview, you gave me an anecdote, a story about the help that you got from a Puerto Rican doctor. Mm-hmm. You want to repeat that story? Because that's quite unique.
Oh, yeah, that was interesting. I have a fortunate experience of knowing this doctor and his wife, Silvia Carrera, and Dr. Jose Carrera. Dr. Jose Carrera is orthopedic surgeon and orthopedic doctor in Mission, one of the most successful, if not in the nation, in Texas at least, in South Texas, is well known for it. He has been a lot of help to my family, my grandparents, and my family as a practice, as a doctor. Dr. Carrera's wife was one of my dad's first teachers when he became principal. That's how our relationship started. And she happens to be a personal friend of the family. As a matter of fact, my sister was her maid of honor when they got married. Well, I hadn't seen Dr. Carrera and Silvia in a while. When we started campaigning, I went to them and asked them for help, and they wholeheartedly endorsed my campaign. He not only wrote a letter as a doctor, as a medical doctor, endorsing me, he included this leaflet right here with a picture of me in his billings. So that when a patient of his, which he had many patients, would open the billings or the letter or any correspondence from his office, they would see a picture of me and obviously them saying, please vote for this gentleman. And also the letter, I mean, they wrote a letter to other patients saying, a long letter saying, and saying, you need to get involved, you need to go vote, you need to go vote for J.D. Sanders, his county clerk. I today still meet people that tell me, oh, you're J.D. Salinas, tú eres Juan de Dios. Sí, señora, ¿por qué? Yo voté por usted porque el Dr. Carrera me dijo que votara por usted. Y cada viernes, every Friday, their staff would wear my shirts. So their patients would see my name. The stickers were in the offices. The stickers were, pushcards were all over their office. And they see a lot of patients in there.
Did you ask him to do that, or that was just his idea?
That was their idea. That was their idea. I think eventually I would have asked him to do that. Pero one day they said, we need about 500 of your push cards. Okay. We didn't include them in our first month. Okay, good. You know, so they, I'm very grateful that they did that, because that was a lot of help. Because I found out and I started remembering my grandmother, both which are alive today. When they talk about the doctors and that the doctor told them today that they need to go take their medicine twice a day or three times a day, it's like the Bible. They do it, okay? So I started realizing the reason that doctors are effective is because they are respected well in the community, and anything the doctor says, they better do. You know, it was really an interesting experience, something that I learned.
Let's get into a section on biography. Tell me about your grandparents on both sides. What are their names? Where are they from? How they got here?
Mi abuelito.
And your parents, and then your own relationship.
Okay, my grandfather, my paternal grandparents, my grandparent on my dad's side, of course, are Juan de Dios Salinas Sr. He was foreman of La Habana Ford, San Fordyce Gravel Company for 20 some years. He died as a foreman at 56 years old in 1965. I was born in 1969, so unfortunate, the only thing I know about him is I read or I hear my grandmother, which he lived in La Habana, small town in the side of La Jolla. Then they moved to La Jolla, and they're one of the first, my understanding, one of the first water wells in La Jolla. So he used to provide water to people for free in the area. My understanding from him, he was a hardworking man and got involved a lot, obviously, has been in the school board for 15 years. My grandmother, Zulema Salinas, her last name is Garza, her main name is Garza. My understanding, she was born in Yorktown, and she lived over there for a while, pero is now living and residing in La Jolla. My maternal grandparents are from Rio Grande City. My grandfather, Manuel Osuna, passed away approximately 1975, heart problem. My mother was the youngest girl in that family of 10. Had just a younger brother. He worked for the school district in Rio Grande City for 30 some years, and retired and passed away. He was a rancher on the side, and spent a lot of time on his ranch. My grandmother, his wife, was Romanita Osuna. Romanita Reina was her maiden name. Also from Rio Grande City, or a small area north of Rio Grande, they used to call La Víboras, an area called La Víboras over there, and that's where they grew up, in a ranch. My mother was born raised in Rio Grande, graduated from Rio Grande City, Mrs. Stark County, 1959. Still joke with her about that.
Beauty queen.
Yeah, she's a beauty queen.
Okay.
Yeah, she was, and I've seen pictures of my mom. She was a beautiful woman, still is today. Very much not only as beauty on the outside, but also on the inside. I call her the heart of the family. She keeps us together. She keeps us believing in faith in God, and reminds us how important it is. My father, I call him the rock of the family. An educator, born in La Habana, graduated in La Jolla High School. He was an all-state quarterback in La Jolla. Went on to play football in Southwest Texas State. As a quarterback, también ahí for a while, then he ended up graduating from the University of Texas Pan American with his bachelor's, and went on advancing as a coach, eventually getting a bid management while he was a coach at Costa City, and going to Corpus Christi State in the summers. I remember going over there with him. He worked in summers at La Piedadera with his father, and his father, my Juan de Dios Sr., was also a rancher on the side, so they worked a lot on ranching and things like that. He had a lot of brothers. Big family, también 10. That's both of my parents at.
What's La Piedrera? Is that a rock quarry or something?
That's a rock quarry. That's where you get rocks. La Habana stands for that rock, so that you can have gravel to for cement and things like that. So that's what it worked. My dad was a head football coach for 14 years. I remember going to 7 different schools in 10 years because of that. I did used to not like it when I was a youngster because I was always a new kid in the class, new kid in the neighborhood, new kid in the city. So here we go meeting new people. I did not appreciate it till after high school and when I was in college. Oh, you're from Pearsall. Oh, yeah, I used to live in Pearsall. Oh, you're from Brownsville. I used to go to school in Brownsville. Eres de Crystal City. Yo también estaba ahí. Remember this. So I appreciated that I had a lot of friends in South Texas. And I got to meet a lot of good friends.
Well, and your work with John Sharp today takes you to 15, 20 counties, no?
I have 13 counties, of which include Crystal City, Uvalde, Pearsall, Zapata. And all of them I lived that one way or another, you know, so it makes it easy to go in there and talk to local officials, businesses to try to get, especially Hispanic businesses to expand and to try to get through the bureaucracy of government, especially state government, the controller's office, because they can make hard, like life hard on you. So that's one of the reasons I enjoy what I'm doing, is because we get to help. Especially minorities and hubs, historically underutilized businesses, to do business in the state of Texas or expand their business.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned a little bit about my dad and the reason that he was a quarterback and things like that. The reason was that when I was young in high school, I thought that the importance of me in high school was to be a good athlete, like my father. Sometimes I would get mad at him because he became a principal. He was not my coach because he did not. I would ask him to spend some of his experiences as an athlete to me so I can hopefully become an athlete. And he didn't, and I didn't understand why. And then now I understand why. Is that he would always say, "I want you to be the best you can be as whatever you do. You don't have to be an athlete. You can be the best." Statesman, politician, Chicano leader, whatever you can be, but do it on your own. You find your niche and find it on your own and be the best you can be like that. Today I appreciate that. After high school, I didn't. I was not as good an athlete as he was, as you know, All-State quarterback. Never missed a day of practice in football. I loved it, this and that. I just wish I could be better. I wish I could be playing football in college because I thought that that's what was important in life as a youngster. You go to A&M, 88% white, 12% minority, very little Hispanics. You see racism again. They say that it's not there. And it makes you learn things and try to do things about some of the situations.
What was some of that you experienced at A&M?
Simple things as pronunciations, the names, Juan, Didias, Salinas, you know, things like that. You know.
Do you get that?
Yeah. So, you know, some of the, a lot of it was not educational experience.
We're back. You were starting to tell me about incidents at A&M, changing your name.
The pronunciation of names and things like that. And they may have not done on purpose, but I don't think they were as, they being the institution, were culturally educated as they should be. I mean, we're supposed to have Hispanics going, being able or supposed to go to A&M, right? They should be culturally educated in that pronunciation of names and things like that are important. I remember one incident of my mentor. I had a bad first semester at Texas A&M. I had a 1.4. I did not do good in some classes. And the second semester was okay, but I was on school probation. And I remember going to my mentor, and it was an older man, and I don't remember his name. And I remember him saying, you may want to think about something other than college. College is not for you. And while I'm not saying they may have been racism, it may have been. Well, needless to say, I did not listen to his advice. I changed my major and I continued at A&M, and I ended up graduating in 4 years, which a lot of students at A&M do not do. Most college students take more than 5 years, that's the average. But I learned I had to take that challenge and prove people wrong, which I've done several times. Even in La Jolla, my counselors, my teachers, you cannot go to a major university and succeed. You can't, so don't even think about it.
That's what they would say?
Yeah.
They're Mexicano counselors?
They're Mexicano counselors. We didn't even have our... I would ask them for the way to register at Texas A&M University. We don't have it here. We don't have the information. And the only reason I went to A&M is because it was a major university in a small town. That's the only reason. Otherwise, I would have gone to University of Texas, but I was afraid of the big town mentality. Coming from a town of 2,000 in La Jolla, I don't like big towns, and I still don't. And that's the only reason I went to College Station. I was the only one from La Jolla there in Texas A&M, and the first one to graduate from La Jolla High School and Texas A&M University. But again, people would say the ones that told me that you can go to college, whatever you decide, are my parents and my head football coach, Lionel Casas. The only ones. There are very few.
Casas?
Casas.
Mm-hmm.
He's a head football coach.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to go to Colorado State University. They were offering to pay my education there.
Scholarship of sorts?
Out of state tuition. Because I was involved with the... I am a alumnus of Lorenzo de Zavala Youth Legislative Session.
The National Hispanic
Institute?
The National
Hispanic Institute. And they recognized that, so I had met some people from Colorado State University. So they had offered to pay my waive my out-of-state tuition, and I was going to go there as my second choice if A&M did not accept me. Third one was the Air Force. But then going back to A&M, there were several experiences that were not only the university but socially. A lot of the fellow students make remarks and social events. Just the invitations to some students, but not to others. You would feel in a classroom, that they would speak to everybody else, but not to lonely Chicano atrás o enfrente.
Was that cultural shock to go from 100% Mexican environment to 100% almost Anglo environment?
No, it wasn't for me. It wasn't for me because I had gone to Pearsall. And I had seen Anglos there. So, we traveled, but it was to some extent, maybe not a culture shock, but if I can make up my own phrase and my own word, it's more like a home shock. And not only that, the local geographically wasn't the same, but the same, even the Hispanic communities were different from Houston and Dallas. Some of them les hablabas español y no entendían. No entendían español, no sabían ni una palabra de español. So it was different. Oh, yo soy
Jesse Ramirez from Houston. ¿Cómo estás? Ay, yo soy del Valle. I don't understand Spanish. So it was different to me. You know, I was for 18 years, like, somebody gave me their Spanish name, like, I would talk to them in Spanish and in English, and, you know, just as a way of comfort. Comfort as Hispanic. To earn their, so they can feel comfortable with me. That was different. And, so soon what we did was the Mexicanos from Rio Grande City and the Mexicanos from El Valle were live in the same complex, we live in my same, my roommates were from El Valle, pa cuidarnos uno al otro, so we could take care of each other, because we soon found out that not all Hispanics are the same, and while others may be, we call them frat daddies, we were not. We were here to get educated and get out of here, you know. So we experience some situations.
A lot of young people today say that there's no discrimination. They don't feel it, that there's no problems with Anglos and blacks and others. Do you think that's true?
A lot of my colleagues, a lot of people my age say that, and I've heard, feel that there's not discrimination today. I don't think it's true. I know it's not. I just graduated from college in 1991. We're sitting in 1998, 7 years ago. I think discrimination exists, even in Nevada. Either we fail to accept it, or we fail to acknowledge it, but it happens. A lot of my colleagues either have not experienced it directly, or have not recognized it. But it is still exists today.
Well, state government is a good example, and even the person you work with, the higher ups and the controller's office are all white. You may be a rare exception, of one of the few directors of the area.
There's 14 of us regional representatives, what we call local government assistants. 14 of us, and there's three of us that are Hispanic. Up to about a year and a half ago, there's two of us. So. We need to change that in the government. Our highest ranking Hispanic is Leo Aguirre. He's a director of support services and not a deputy chief of staff like other from other cultural backgrounds are. And I think that we need to change and be more sensitive to the Hispanic community. And while you may be from South Texas, and you may have grown here, you may have were born here. I think only Hispanics who have lived it recognize Hispanic situations. And that's it. So in other words, you cannot tell me that a deputy chief of staff from South Texas being Anglo will recognize Hispanic concerns, because the person he or she was born here, grew up here in South Texas, and recognized. While they may recognize some of the situations, they are not recognized wholeheartedly. All situations. This is my question.
Let me ask you about the Lorenzo Zavala legislative session that you attended, the training, the National Hispanic Institute. How did you get recruited? What was that all about? How did that help you?
I was a sophomore in high school, you know, and it was a great experience. It was a sophomore in high school, Ernesto
Nieto
and Gloria
De Leon
called some counselors in La Jolla and said, yeah, give us some of your best students, bring them over on Sundays, it's University of Texas Pan American, we're going to talk to them about leadership and leadership education and stuff like that. I was chosen. Gladly, and then went to, from La Jolla, I used to go to, University of Texas Pan American. First event was called the Great Debate, and we used to learn about local issues, statewide issues, and debate about them. We went to Austin then, and we had what we called the Great Debate. From there, the Lorenzo de Zavala Youth Legislative National Hispanic Institute developed the Youth Legislative Session. Very important, because it was like voice state and girl state that I've always heard about,
but I never got included. You know, La Jolla did not have an American Legion, so they couldn't choose a boy to go to Boys State or Girls State. I used to hear about our kids from other colleges, I mean high schools in the Valley used to go to Boys State, spend time in Austin and learn about the capital and things like that. The youth, Lorenzo de Zavala Youth Legislative Session, did that. We spent 2 weeks in Georgetown and we learned about the legislative processes and got involved and elected our own state representatives, our own senators, filed our own bills and things like that. So it was a great experience. I mean, it gave you some sense of challenge of leadership, challenge of cooperation, team player with fellow Hispanics. So we learned that there was other Hispanics in the state of Texas that were just as smart as we were, and we could we can elect our own governor and things like that. And talk about issues like House Bill 72 at that time, the seatbelt law was being talked about, the helmet law, and we challenged each other. Why do you feel it's important? Why? Why is House Bill 72 no pass, no play? Why is that important for the educational system? So it was a great learning experience. Got to meet other people and it challenged you to learn.
Are you active in the Alumni Association now?
I'm not as active as I'd like to be, but I keep in touch with Edison and Gloria and I try to get involved as much as I can.
Okay, let's pick up a couple of little housekeeping things we left off. You didn't give the name of your mother, the heart of the family,
my heart of the family.
And your brothers and sisters, who they are, and then your own relationship.
Okay, my mother is Dora Salinas. Her maiden name is Osuna, and
is that with an S or a Z?
Z O Z U N A, Osuna. And the I have an older sister and a younger brother. I'm the middle one in the family. That's the underachiever. Supposedly, sociology and psychology says that. First one in the family is supposed to be the valedictorian and this and that. The youngest one is supposed to be the joker because they're looking for attention. The one in the middle is supposed to be forgotten, the underachiever. So maybe since I was born or from my younger brother was born, I've been challenged to try to do good. But my older sister, her name is Delinda. Delinda Elena Salinas, now married and has twin girls and a 7-year-old daughter and lives in Mission. She's a teacher. Right now is not teaching because she has twins in Mission. My younger brother is 9 years younger than I am. My older sister is 5 years older than I am. My younger brother is 9 years younger than I am. His name is Carlos Daniel Salinas. And he's special to the family because he's a head injury victim and we take care of him a lot. But he's the youngest one in our family. Did I forget my wife? I've been married a year now, and it was pretty interesting because I got married in April 12th of 97, and in the same year, 4 months later, I got involved in a countywide election for county clerk. We were still on a honeymoon, you know, per se. Pero my wife is Lilia Treviño. She's from Alamo. She got her bachelor's from University of Texas Pan American, a master's in speech communications from University of Texas Pan American, is a pharmaceutical rep for Abbott Laboratories and travels Corpus Christi South. And she's not only my best friend, but also my speech communications team because she has her master's in that. She's also my speech writer and amongst other things. So she's very important to my life. That's my family now. We hope to plan one in a couple of years. We want to travel for at least a year. And take off is in January, maybe take another trip in the summer, and from there plan our family.
What are your long-term objectives? Personal, political, economic?
Personally, I'm going to strive as much as I can, whether I'm an elected official or not. As long as the taxpayers want me, they can vote me in. And as long as my wife agrees with me to run again, I'm going to be involved in the betterment of Hispanic and Chicanos education and livelihood and lifestyle. Whether it takes me to be county clerk to do that, or it takes me to be a school board member, it takes me to be congressman, it takes me to be whatever it may be. That is my personal goal. Financially, I want to be financially independent, hopefully with investments in my wife also being a worker in the family. I want to be financially independent early in life, and early meaning by 60, 55 years old, so that we can travel and spend more time in those kind of things, like betterment of education in Spanish. I have been asked whether I'm going to run for other offices or not. Today, I'm going to be county clerk for the next 4 years, try to better that office, provide better services, especially to the rural areas and colonias. I mean, there's areas in the county, Hidalgo, where you have to pay long distance to call the county clerk's office. Providing an 800 number, you can take care of these things. We shouldn't have to let our indigent constituents, especialmente en las colonias, pagar larga distancia para hablar con la oficina, que son de ellos también. So those are some of the things I'm going to work on. Short-term goals. And eventually long-term, like I said, that's going to be my key, is betterment of Hispanics, especially South Texas Hispanics and their livelihood.
But you've used both words, Hispanic and Chicano. What label do you prefer?
Both of them. As a matter of fact, I got involved in the Chicano Law Students Association fight in TSU, even though I was not involved with the university. I had a good friend, Richard Cantu, who was an alumnus at TSU, and they wanted to change the name of Chicano to Hispanic. And I told him that Chicano was the proper name for us, you know, for those who identify with this, what I feel is the struggle and what is important to Hispanics. I use both because, it's just used transversely.
You have emphasized travel. Where do you want to go?
With my family, personally, I'd like to visit interior Mexico. I've never been in interior Mexico on some of the beaches. That's where I would like to visit.
Let me turn this off. We're back and running low on battery. I want to thank you for taking time to do this and postponing all the calls and visits. The last question is if you've got anything to say about your career or your ambitions or your travels or anything we left off or something I cut you off on. Or
No, I just want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell you my personal experiences and for our point of view. I say us as young Hispanics because there isn't young Hispanics that's 29 years old that are talking and let it trying to open doors for us to advance, and I think it's important. My personal ambitions are going to be to try to continue our struggle to better life for Hispanics, and especially in South Texas.
Are there young people like yourself getting elected across the valley? Is it changing? Is the old guard over?
Yeah, they're getting younger and younger, but like our next county judge, I think, is older 30s. I'm the youngest, I believe, the youngest countywide elected official in the history of Hidalgo County, other than Lloyd Benson. Lloyd Benson was 21 years old when he was appointed county judge, but he was never elected. So I hope that this opens the doors for younger Hispanics, professional Hispanics, to get involved and learn about the issues and try to better our community.
You may get cut off on the answer because the battery is running low, but the Valley for the longest time was the stereotype that that's where the Mexicans were, that's where the Mexican vote was. All the major politicians always ran to the Valley to get the Mexican vote. Mm-hmm. That's not the case anymore. There's more in Houston. There's probably more in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, North Texas area, than the Valley. San Antonio and Austin combined probably has more than the Valley. So the Valley is going to lose that prominence. Mm-hmm. Do you see it that way, or how are you going to try to leverage to get your share when you got all these other groups now across the state?
Yeah, I agree, but you got to remember that, for example, Hidalgo County is one of the top three metropolitan areas in growth rate in the nation. So no matter what happens, our growth rate is expanding. And if we're not popular by vote or Hispanic vote, we're going to be popular by economic development. And we need to get involved with education, or educating our local youth, so that we can have a better quality of life, because business is coming. I mean,
what is fueling that? What's driving this third fastest growing area in the nation, as you said?
There's a net migration. I mean.